Let me remind everybody to please turn your cell phones on when you leave at 4 o'clock, okay? We've been fortunate so far in that only one went off, but please turn them on when you leave. Let me introduce John Schmidt, who's a former retired American Foreign Service officer who served in Pakistan for several years and is the author of a fine book on Pakistan and militants in Pakistan. And John will then introduce the panel. John?
Thank you, Steve, and welcome everybody to The Future of Pakistan, Part 2. I'm going to launch right into speaker introductions. We'll get them out of the way, and then we'll have them introduce their remarks. Immediately to my left is Pamela Constable, who's currently a staff writer for The Washington Post. She has extensive experience in covering Pakistani affairs, having served as a South Asia bureau chief for the Post from 1999 to 2002. That's when I got to know her. She was also bureau chief in Kabul from 2002 to 2004. She's continued to follow events in the region very closely, as reflected in her new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, in which she paints a vivid portrait of the country and its many problems. Bruce Rydell on my far right is a senior fellow here at Brookings and himself a leading authority on South Asian affairs. A career CIA officer, Bruce has served in many senior positions in the U.S. government, including as a senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs at the NSC during the Clinton administration. He was an advisor to the Obama presidential campaign on South Asia and chaired an interagency review of U.S. policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan during the early months of the Obama administration. And he's the author of his own recent book on Pakistan entitled Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America, and the Future of the Global Jihad. On my far left is Joshua White, the youngster of our panel. He's a PhD candidate at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a Jennings Randolph Peace Scholar at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He spent extensive time in Pakistan doing research and has presented his findings in numerous academic and policy forums and in a testimony before the Congress. He's also an active participant in several high-level U.S.-Pakistani Track 2 strategic dialogues. His current doctoral work focuses on decision-making in Islamic parties in Pakistan. And last, but certainly not least, to my right is Marvin Weinbaum, who's a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute and professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois, where he was director of the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He's also served as analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department, where I first got to know him. He's written extensively on Pakistani topics for a wide variety of foreign policy journals and book anthologies. He is and has long been one of this country's leading authorities on Pakistan. So as with the previous group, I'd like to invite our panelists to gaze out at the next 5 to 7 years of the future of Pakistan, predict where it's headed. It's now been a year and a half since the Bellagio conference was held, and arguably the biggest change that has happened in the region during that period has been the dramatic downturn in U.S.-Pakistani relations. And I would ask our panelists to try to funnel that phenomenon into their 5-minute remarks and discuss where things may be headed in that relationship, which suddenly seems to have an enormous, likely to have an enormous impact over Pakistan over the short to medium term. And without further ado, then, let me turn to Pamela.
Can you all hear me? Is this on? How about that? Well, we're sort of at a, both an advantage and disadvantage in the second panel. A great deal has already been said over the last hour and a half. And I don't want to repeat a lot of the points that were being made before. We don't have that much time if we're true to our schedule, less than 45 minutes. So I'm going to be very telegrammatic here, just to make some bullet points so that we can have more time for discussion. Two things I want to say first. One, a previous speaker talked about the fluidity of events, of which I'm certainly a minor victim. I had to revise my recent book something like six times after it was, quote, unquote, finished and at the publisher to accommodate such things as floods covering the country of Pakistan, the extension of General Kayani, the killing of Salman Taseer, and then worst of all, for many reasons, the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden, of which we were only able to get something like one sentence into the final version of the book. The second point I want to make is that, you know, in reading through all these chapters and listening through all these comments, I'm struck by the extraordinary commonality of the diagnosis. I mean, speaker after speaker, chapter after chapter, everybody seems to generally agree on a set list of problems that Pakistan has been facing for a very long time and continues to face. It's also striking how pretty bleak the prognosis seems to be. I haven't heard much in the way of sort of optimistic forward-looking places for hope. You know, if you look at the places that people would like to think of as hopeful, there's always a downside, media being one that comes to mind. Media is an incredible potential for positive change in a place like Pakistan, but it also has a terrible downside. It's not only exposing scandals, it's also pandering to the lowest common denominator in many cases, which is, you know, extreme emotionalism, anti-foreigner, anti-Americanism, lots of bad things happening with this great new media. The judiciary, there's been enormous hope in the lawyers' movement, the judiciary, Supreme Court, a Chief Justice restored to power. That, too, has had its disappointing side. Not that much has changed as a result of the restoration of Mr. Chaudhry. The lawyers' movement, which had its shining moments several years ago, has been quite a disappointment since there, the nadir of which, I think, was, in fact, the positive reception that Mumtaz Qadri got at the courthouse when he was brought there after having assassinated the appointed governor of Punjab. So, yes, there are some positive points, but generally speaking, I think we all agree things are not going very well. I want to talk about a couple of things where I think there are some opportunities, possibly, for help. I mean, for ways that things could be improved. I want to talk about, since we're being asked to, first, the U.S.-Pakistan relation. We all know it's getting worse. We all know the reasons why it's getting worse. I want to focus particularly on this issue because I worked a lot about that on the 2 years I spent researching my recent book, and that is public opinion. It is very, very true that, yes, most Pakistanis do not support terrorism. Most Pakistanis do not support al-Qaeda or the Taliban or cutting off people's hands. But at the same time, you know, the body of evidence shows that anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism has never been higher in Pakistan than it is now. It is across the board, and we're not talking, as other speakers have said, we're not just talking about poor, alienated, struggling people. We're talking about all kinds of people. We're talking about broad public sentiment. And I would posit that there are two reasons this is happening. Well, three, I guess. One is, and I've said this in some recent talks, perhaps some of you have heard about when I'm talking about my book. What I see happening is this growing confluence of not what I call the al-Qaeda school of thought, but of two other phenomena, one of which is what I call a growing emotional and a very, very emotionalistic defensiveness about Islam. People in Pakistan, many of them feel that their religion is under threat from the West. I don't necessarily think that's true, but I acknowledge that many people in Pakistan feel that it's true. That needs to be addressed. There needs to be a much more powerful, 1 minute, my God. There needs to be a much more powerful counter-narrative from the West and from moderates within Pakistan and their supporters abroad. That, it needs to be countered. Pakistanis, especially the youth, not only the youth, feel frustration. People feel alienated from the state. People feel they have nowhere to turn. They're getting very mixed messages from their leaders, from television, from politicians, from religious leaders. They don't really have anything to grab onto except their religion. And there are many ways they can go. I say that the youth of Pakistan is very much up for grabs right now. You know, if you look just what's happening on the campus of Punjab University, and the appeasement that's going on and the sort of ceding of space to the radical student movement, it's very, very alarming. Now, we don't have enough time here to talk about solutions, but I think there are many areas where, if you want to put it simply, shoring up moderation, shoring up the traditional version of Pakistani Islam, and trying to isolate the extremes and the fringes, whether that happens from within or with help from without. It's really the only thing that's going to make a big difference in the long run. We have to win them over. We cannot destroy them with drones. Thanks.
Thank you, Pamela. And now I'd like to turn to Bruce Rydell, who is one of the architects of Obama administration policy toward the region and recently did a piece in the New York Times on containment, which Chris Fair mentioned during the first panel. So over to you, Bruce.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with such a distinguished group. I want to underscore, first of all, the importance of this project. I've been benefiting from it from its inception in being able to read all the drafts, and I can say very honestly that the Deadly Embrace would not be the book that it is without having benefited from all those drafts. And I want to particularly thank Steve Cohen for organizing this project and doing all the hard work to make it come together. We are once again in a debt to his leadership. Because of the time and because of a very sore throat, I'm going to try to make only 2 points very briefly regarding Pakistan's immediate future, the next 3 to 5 years. First is, I fear that we are seeing the creeping establishment of Pakistan's fifth military dictatorship underway right now. What do I mean by that? It's not going to be a repeat of the Musharraf era or of the Zia era. It's going to be something more subtle and more nuanced than that. But I think in many ways it is another military dictatorship. And dictatorship means that there is a group in power that makes decisions irrelevant to what the popular vote, what the popular majority is, and what the elected government is. And I think that that's a phenomenon we're increasingly seeing in today's Pakistan. And Shuja laid out the notion of the four-legged Pakistani political system, which has been in essence for the last 3 years. I think we're seeing a qualitative change in the power of those four legs underway today. Now, some will say this was always inevitable, that the Zardari government, because of the nature of who the president was, the nature of how it came to power, was probably doomed to fail. But that's clearer in retrospect than it was in 2008 or 2009. Some will also say Zardari's weaknesses, and they're profound, and they go to the very core of the politician that he is, made all of this inevitable. But that, I think, too, is the benefit of 2020 hindsight. The new military dictatorship that's emerging in Pakistan, the fifth military dictatorship, will be very different from its predecessors. The facade of civilian government is likely to continue to go on. We'll still have a president and a prime minister. There'll be a foreign minister. They'll have all the trappings of power. But behind that, they'll have very little of the real powers of power. The media will continue to be very active and alive, except when it criticizes the army too seriously, at which point the journalist who did so will be terminated thoroughly. The judiciary will be able to do what it wants to do as long as it doesn't challenge the military. Behind the scenes, the Army will decide the key issues of national security and allocation of resources. Now, here again, one can say this is not new in Pakistan. It's been going on for a long time. But that was in some dispute over the last 3 years. There was an attempt by civilians to change that. The civilian government itself and many of its leaders, and I would say this includes the president, are increasingly intimidated and, frankly, scared to death of what the military can do. Memogate is the ultimate illustration of all this and is a phenomenon that is accelerating this process right as we speak. It's ironic, since the whole purpose of the memo in Memogate was to prevent a military dictatorship. It is, in fact, facilitating the development of a military dictatorship. I hope that whoever wrote the memo, and I hope that whoever wrote about the memo in the Financial Times, can live with their conscience about what they've done in the interests of self-promotion. The model that Pakistan is becoming, I think, unfortunately, is a South Asian version of Algeria, a country in Algeria where the military rules behind the scenes. It's very hard to even know who in the military is ruling behind the scenes. Le pouvoir, an assembly of generals who makes decisions behind curtains, behind false fronts all the time. Not a single powerful person, but a collection of them. In the case of Pakistan, it is, of course, the corps commanders. The good news is I don't think this process is irrevocable yet. I think it can still be turned around. I think Pakistanis, if they want to, can prevent this from happening. I think new elections that produce a strong mandate for a new government could yet turn this around. It is no guarantee by any means, but it's certainly a possibility. But left on the steady drift that it is, I see Pakistan going into its fifth military dictatorship. The second point I would make is also, I think, one that's probably relatively simple, and that is that the United States and NATO today and Pakistan, on the other hand, are fighting a proxy war in Afghanistan. Now, this has been true since 2005 as well, but many of the veils behind this proxy war are now falling apart, falling very, very quickly. And the Bonn conference today is the latest example of the veils falling apart. The entire world, the United Nations, NATO, and the international community is backing the Karzai government, and the Pakistan government, for one reason or another, is not there. It's backing the Taliban, and it has been backing the Taliban for some time. The assassination of President Rabbani on September 20th was a defining milestone in this process because it clearly put Pakistan on the side of a force that does not want to negotiate, which is not interested in a political process. Up until September 20th, we could hope that there would be a political process in Afghanistan. When that bomb went off in the turban, that hope came to an end. Pakistan and the United States and NATO find themselves on an increasingly dangerous and escalatory collision course in Afghanistan. There are some breaks built into the system. Whether they will prove to be strong enough to prevent disaster from happening, I think, is becoming an increasingly open question.
Thank you, Bruce, and now I'd like to turn to Joshua White.
Thank you. It's great to be back at Brookings and see so many familiar faces in the audience. I want to make one brief point per the moderator's suggestion about the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, and then three very brief points about what I see looking ahead in Pakistan that come out of the chapter in this book. The first on the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, Bruce has written a lot in recent weeks about containment, about a shift toward a policy of containment toward Pakistan. Chris Fair mentioned that as well. I think there's a lot to commend that line of reasoning, given the direction that the relationship is moving. I think at the same time, it's not the most helpful construct, and I just want to explain why I think that's the case. I think a lot of people use containment as a shorthand, as Chris mentioned, for limited cooperation on matters of mutual interest in the environment of some discord. And I think that that can be an element of a policy of containment, as we saw during the Cold War. But you can also call that any number of other things. You can call that a modest transactional relationship. You can call that limiting the scope of our objectives and what we're going to be able to accomplish and be realistic about the areas in which we disagree. The other another characteristic of containment that's often brought to light is that containment means planning for the worst case. And on this point, I would contend that we already do that. We do a lot of planning for the worst case. We plan for realistic worst case scenarios, non-proliferation, or should I say proliferation scenarios that are worst case. We spend a lot of time planning for what happens if there's another Mumbai attack. What is the fallout of that? And there are a number of contributors to this book who trace some of those processes. We also spend a lot of time planning for highly unrealistic worst-case scenarios. You know, what if the Taliban roll into Islamabad and decide then to do something there? I think we already occupy ourselves with this kind of planning. And again, we don't need to call that containment as such. Third and most important, I think one of the signature characteristics of containment is putting pressure on proxies. That is, contestation not directly but at the periphery. We saw this during the Cold War. And here again, I think the metaphor doesn't entirely fit because our primary area of peripheral engagement with Pakistan is in Afghanistan. It is the proxy engagement that is currently carrying on in Afghanistan, and that, if anything, I think is likely to decrease over time. And the one area where we're likely to continue to engage Pakistan at the periphery is in relation to those groups that come from Pakistan to engage in kind of transnational activities, transnational terrorism. So all that to say, to frame this, I think there is something changing in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. The scope is narrowing. There's more suspicion. There's going to be even more planning for worst-case scenarios. But I think we can call that something other than containment. I think there are other constructs, other ways to think about what's happening. In my chapter, I touch on a number of different things which I saw or which I sort of speculated about looking ahead in Pakistan, and I want to touch briefly just on three of them. The first is what's going to happen with Islamism in Pakistan. I spent a lot of time thinking about this and writing about this. I spent a lot of time talking with Islamist political leaders in Pakistan, as I know Pamela has as well. And I'd like to highlight what Chris Fair mentioned, which is that one of the really disturbing, surprising, shocking things has been the vitriol and the violence directed against what has traditionally been seen as a more moderate expression, a more moderate branch of Islam in Pakistan. We've seen that with bombings against shrines, which have increased in the last several years. What we've also seen, which is even more disturbing, are elements of those supposedly moderate groups that have become violent as well. And this was mentioned by the questioner in seeing the attack on Salman Taseer, which brought to the surface a whole stream of radicalism that many people hadn't seen before. And what I take away from this is not that everybody is crazy in Pakistan. What I take away from this is that we have to see the dividing line not so much as between the liberals and the extremists, and I always ask, well, what's the balance today between the liberals and the extremists? But to look inside of all of the groups that we find in Pakistan and to ask some more focused questions, like what do they believe about who can enforce the Sharia? Because a lot of these questions really come down to very focused questions of who can take Sharia into their own hands, who can take force into their own hands to enforce Islam. And I think as we look to the future, the dividing lines between those groups that are going to be more stabilizing and those that are destabilizing will fall along questions like this, not along who's a liberal and who's not. Second, I mentioned in the chapter, I sort of speculated about the prospect of a center-right government emerging in Pakistan. And at the time, I said, well, this may be a Nawaz Sharif government, a Nawaz Sharif-like government which emerges. And I think if I were to adjust Now I would say, well, that would be an Imran Khan government or an Imran Khan-like government that would emerge. And we could have, a very interesting discussion about what that might look like and how it might impact U.S.-Pakistan relations. But in short, I think it wouldn't do anything dramatic to the relationship, but it would allow some of the military centers of power and others to deflect even more of their problems with the United States onto the parliament, rendering them moot, and would, I think we would all expect, facilitate a much sort of wider outcry against the United States. I've also, in studying Islamic politics, I talked to some of the Islamist parties about, you know, who they would like to align with in the next election. If it turns out that there is a center-right government, I would expect that some of those parties would like to be part of it. And given the devolution reforms of the 18th Amendment, there's now a whole host of opportunities at the provincial level for policymaking that didn't used to exist, which is to say there are a host of opportunities for Islamist parties and coalition to play around with education policy and with health policy and other things in ways that they couldn't in the past. One final point, because I know this has been a somewhat discouraging afternoon, the one... I don't know if I'll say it's a bright spot, but the one area where I take issue with some who are very dour about Pakistan is when I look at the ethno-nationalist problems of Pakistan, the questions of Pashtunistan or of ethnic fragmentation or of the state sort of spinning apart like an Iranian centrifuge on Stuxnet, you know, all these sort of terrible visions of what the state will become. I'm more sanguine on this point. And that's because I think that Pashtunistan was never, or at least in the last couple of decades, hasn't been a viable construct to begin with. And in fact, the most troubling kind of Pashtun nationalism I can imagine is one in which the Taliban actually get really smart and decide to appropriate it for their own purposes, which to date they haven't done. On the other hand, we see that the government's done a lot of very positive things. The 18th Amendment devolved a number of powers. The National Finance Commission Award met a lot of the demands of those in the frontier province. For example, there have been little outbursts of demands for a Saraiki province and a Hazara province. All of these, I think, are possible over time as part of a grand political bargain. And I think that the state has actually been quite adept. I realize I just said that Pakistan, the state, has been quite adept at dealing with this and at meeting some demands in a minimal sense in order to preclude broader vociferous tendencies in the society. And in this sense, I think I wouldn't say they borrowed a lesson from what India did in the 1950s and 60s with its state reorganization, but there are certainly parallels to how they have quieted some of these tendencies. And I think in this sense, the state is more coherent than people often give it credit for. Thank you.
Thank you, Joshua. Now, Marvin Weinbaum.
Thank you, John. Well, I guess you'll come away from this session here saying Pakistan is in crisis, and I can understand why. The trouble is that for so long, those of us who have been watching Pakistan have been saying Pakistan's in crisis. So this is hardly a new observation. In fact, the meaning of crisis for Pakistan is perhaps lost. What we recognize here is that many of the ingredients that we would have thought would be game changers along the way just never came to fruition. Whether it's because the vehicles for change were not there, whatever it was, we've tended to focus a good deal. We've had to on a certain resiliency in spite of everything. Maybe an inertia, but in any case, that the spark was not there, and so it's not surprising that when I wrote my chapter and I laid out six possible scenarios, which includes just about all of what we've heard this afternoon, I assigned probabilities to them, and I gave the greatest probability to muddling through. And I don't entirely back away from that. It just seems, given what we know about the country, what we know about the propensity for change when all the same players seem to be on the scene perpetually. And everything changes, but nothing really changes, although even with this continuity scenario, there will be changes. Well, we also have word that it's okay because there is a silent majority out here. We've heard that before, and that somehow they stand apart here. If only they had an opportunity to express themselves. And so it's the deep state which is taking this away from them. They are really more reasonable, more likely to be tolerant and so on. And if you don't like silent majority, which is such a vague term, civil society is there. And if you give it time, it's going to be able to step up and put one of my best scenarios for Pakistan, put it certainly on that track. So that's where I was when I wrote the chapter. And I say I'm not backing away from entirely, but I must say that the events of this year have led me to question whether it is going to be business as usual. We've seen a series of developments here, of shocks to the Pakistan system, to the relationship with the United States, which are really worrying. For example, what we once thought of as the jihadi narrative, some of the conspiracy theories that were once kind of fringe expressions. You can't leave Pakistan or read Pakistan's media or whatever and not say these have become a consensus. So we come back to a word that was used earlier. Are we seeing something qualitatively different emerge here? I leave open that possibility that what has happened here is that you can't say, well, it's the army simply manipulating things anymore, because it seems in some ways as if the aware public, the politically aware public, has gone beyond perhaps even where the military wants to be. And in fact, what we have seen here is that the ability of the policy elites to act with a certain amount of independence here of the public, which they have done right along here, one story for the public, one as they deal with us, their degrees of freedom have apparently shrunk. So I wonder, and then I see something like what happened, the media, the free media, and the cable owners apparently met a day or two ago, and they came out in favor of suppressing stories written abroad that were critical of Pakistan. And now these are the champions of expression. The cable media has opened up all kinds of opportunities. So what I'm really concerned about, and I think others in this panel have reflected on in one way or another, is to say, are there things in the fabric of society which has been a strong element here of continuity, but is it being torn by the kind of rhetoric that is we're hearing consistently here, where this jihadi narrative, which has not just anti-Americanism, but its enemies, Islam is challenged. It's gone further, and if they can't, they don't have to win elections. If they've won the soul of the country, and that's the insidious development here. And finally, let me say that it's important here because as we try to dialogue with Pakistan, we like to think that we can work within rational boundaries. But if we face an interlocutor here that is not responding to what we would consider, we'd have to say non-rational arguments and assumptions, it leaves us to wonder whether we can reach what we have to. We recognize we have to. Pakistan is there. We need one another. we've got to find at least those common denominators on which we can find agreement. It's in both of our interests. My concern is obviously how much more difficult that's become now. And without any, as has been suggested here, no one has suggested the way out of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Marvin. Before opening the floor to questions, I'd just like to add my own cautionary note on U.S.-Pakistani relations. Things are bad now, very bad, basically because our goals in Afghanistan are incompatible. The Pakistanis want a friendly state. They don't think the Karzai government is that state, and they're afraid of growing Indian influence in the country. But if we push too hard, the danger is that things could get a whole lot worse. If we were to come in particular to blows with the Pakistan Army, which, like it or not, is the only force in Pakistani society strong enough to prevent a jihadist takeover of the state. And I would simply leave you with a paraphrase of Colin Powell, who said famously of Iraq, break it and you own it. So now, floor for questions, and please identify yourselves when called upon. Najum.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Idle. You talk of a fifth creeping coup, which is going to be very different from the sort of coups we've seen in the past. Now, is this going to be a function of the structural changes in the makeup of the Pakistan Army, its officer corps that have taken place in the last 15 years, which we've discussed today, in terms of the development of homespun lower middle class army officers, and the fact that they're not terribly interlinked with the West in view of what has happened in the last 20 years? And secondly, to what extent is this going to be due to the personality of the army chief? And because army chiefs tend to have different personalities and tend to play different roles, and tend to articulate the interests of their institution in different ways.
I very carefully avoided using the phrase coup, because I don't think you're ever going to say there was a moment in which there was a coup d'etat in this dictatorship. The process is much more slow-moving than that, much more insidious. It's a process of power all moving into the hands of the army leadership. If you look back to 2008, it wasn't in that case, even in 2009. Are changes in the officer corps leading it? I think changes in the officer corps may affect the tone of what this new dictatorship looks like, and it will be more anti-American than ever before. And as anyone who's spoken to young Pakistani army officers knows, the intensity of anti-Americanism among young Pakistani officers is truly astounding and very, very worrisome. The personality of Chief of Army Staff in this coup is less important in this dictatorship than it was in previous ones. I can see and envision a situation in which Kayani leaves after the end of his tour, but the de facto military dictatorship continues with just a new Chief of Army Staff. I think it's the collective leadership which is making the decisions now. In that sense, Kayani is a transformational figure in that he doesn't seek all power in his hands, at least yet. At least yet.
Could I add, do you mind if I add a point? I'd just like to add two quick points that weren't raised before about the military. One is that it's important to remember that the most important thing in many ways for the Army leadership is public opinion. They don't want to be out in front of public opinion, which is why they waited so long to actually move against the Taliban and didn't until they were sure they had it. Public opinion is getting more conservative and more emotionally Islamic, and I think that's very important to remember because the same people are there, you know, civilians and military. It's the same society. And I think that the Army, if you look at what happened after the assassination of Osama bin Laden, they were completely caught off guard, completely upset by this at the top. I think the Army leadership, we think of it as a top-down institution. I think they're very worried about more extreme Islamic values and beliefs bubbling up from the very bottom of the rank and file. I think that's really important to add. Thank you.
Yes, I would also add that really there's really not that much of a change. I mean, the Army has basically always called the shots on national security issues and has been inclined to let the civilians, particularly when civilians are in power, sort of run domestic affairs and particularly economic affairs. So I don't think that there's anything at all unusual about what's going on now. It's more all a reaction to this current dramatic downturn in U.S.-Pakistani relations, which has precipitated all this. Next speaker, right down in front here.
I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhry with the Pakistan American League. I've listened to all the panelists in both these discussions, and it was very enlightening. Steve writes beautifully what he has written. He always writes his analysis and observation in poetry, and he has done it again. And every time he says, it's my last book, and I tell him, no, it's your second last book. one of my observations, Christ, she had mentioned that Imran Khan is being backed by the Pakistan Army. I think I tend to, and I'm inclined to disagree with her. The only reason Imran Khan is picking up support and is becoming popular because every political party in Pakistan right now is in power in some shape or the other. So people are frustrated with each leader and every party. So when they look back, they don't see anybody else other than Imran Khan, who doesn't have a career to be criticized in politics. He has no experience of governance. And my question is to Bruce, a very dear friend. A few years ago, when we were having lunch, you mentioned your recommendation to the Obama administration is the support of democratic institutions and consolidation of democracies, legislative strengthening. And after making that recommendation, how do you think the political establishment or the democracy is working in Pakistan? Number two is that where do you see the silver lining where the war on terrorism could be bring to a closure, and the extremist in Islamist militarism is marginalized, and how can we realign, reinforce, and make this relationship between U.S. and Pakistan more sustainable, which is critical both for not only for both countries, even for the region, and even for the global peace. Thank you. And say it without inshallah.
Silver linings are hard to find here today. You asked me how I think the support for civilian government has turned out over the last 3 years, and I think I've made it clear it's not doing well. I don't think that's the fault of the American effort to back it up, although I think we've made mistakes. I think it has more to do with the dynamics of internal Pakistani politics. In 2009, President Obama embarked on a policy towards Pakistan, which I call, they don't call it, but I call it, engagement with drones. That strategy, I think, made sense at the time, but I think in light of the two developments I laid out, the growing weakness of the civilian government and the growing intensification of the proxy war, it's time to shift to a policy of engagement and containment. That is to say, to continue to engage Pakistan, to try to support the development of civilian democratic government, to try to help the Pakistani economy develop, to try to help Pakistanis, but at the same time try to contain the worst ambitions and excesses of the Pakistani army. That's a very, very difficult balance to do. Right now we're not doing enough on the containment part. We're slipping and sliding into it, but without, I think, a coherent framework. I also want to underscore a point that Pamela made earlier, which is drones by themselves is not a sufficient policy. And I think there's also been a tendency in this administration to become more and more prone to using the drone as the solution to the problem. Drones are an effective tactical instrument. They are not a strategic policy. And we need to reset our policy towards one of engagement and containment.
I think we have time for one more question.
My name is Jugnu Mohsen. I'm the publisher of the Friday Times from Lahore. My question is to Mr. Rydell. You mentioned the creeping coup. You mentioned a possible game changer in new elections. And then you mentioned disaster if the U.S. and Pakistan continue on a collision course. I just want to say, as a Pakistani, that I believe that new elections will not be the game changer that we hope they might be, because the verdict of the people will be more divided. I think that, therefore, it will be more easy for those who have crept in via coup to carry on manipulating the polity as they do at the moment. So my question is, given the probability that we will continue on this course, what do you think disaster will be? Could you please spell out what you mean by disaster?
There are any number of disasters out there. Another Mumbai attack, a mass terrorist casualty incident in the United States of America that's postmarked Pakistan, like Times Square. More and more conflict on the Durand line between NATO forces and Pakistani forces, becoming, in effect, a hot war. It could be a limited hot war, but a hot war. But, you know, I would prefer not to end on the disasters that are coming, because I know it is easy to fall into the trap of extreme pessimism about Pakistan. You're almost always right when you go down that road. I prefer to go down the road of optimism about Pakistan, and I remain an optimist about Pakistan, largely because of the Pakistani people and because of what I see written about in Pakistani media. Pakistani media today is filled with a lot of scary, made-up stories, but it's also filled with a lot of thoughtful opinion pieces by people who recognize what's going on in their country and who lay out things that should be done for its better. And for me, that is a source of optimism, which leaves me with a feeling that Pakistan may not muddle along so much, but will somehow get by. And I don't rule out the possibility that we might even have some silver lining someday, inshallah, for the people of Pakistan.
You know, my fear is that the United States doesn't necessarily have the ability to make things better in Pakistan, but it sure does have the ability to make things worse. And I hope we act responsibly in our relations with Pakistan in the future. And with that, I turn it back to Steve.
Good.
That mic isn't working, so I'll use this one.
Let me thank this panel and the first panel, where I think was a brilliant series of discussions. Enlightened series of discussions on Pakistan. When I wrote my book on the idea of Pakistan in 2004, I said this could be America's major foreign policy problem by the end of the decade. I think, unfortunately, I was right. But I agree with Bruce. I think pessimism is not the role. I worked for George Shultz once, and he said hope is not a policy. But then I talked to a Pakistani diplomat friend in Islamabad while preparing for this book. He said despair is not a policy either. So somewhere is between hope and despair. In my chapter, which had the benefit of reading all these other chapters, I said, look at the question of, is Pakistan irretrievable? Now, what should we be doing? I hope you get the book, hope you read the book, and we welcome questions and comments. Thank you very much. Also, one more point. My first book on Pakistan, the Pakistan Army, was banned in Pakistan. I hope, given what Marvin Weinbaum said, this program is not banned in Pakistan.